Hello and welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today you find us in 19th century Paris, in a narrow passageway near the Seine, as we look through a gloomy window into a haberdasher's shop, where two women sit, surrounded by wool and thread and buttons, silent in the semi-darkness. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously, and joining us today is the novelist Andrew O'Hagan and the other novelist, Rachel Joyce.
Yay.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome.
There are only two novelists and we've got both of them. Andrew O'Hagan was born in Glasgow. He has been nominated for the Booker Prize, was voted one of Granter's Best of Young British Novelists in 2003 and won the E.M. Forster Prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He's editor-at-large of the London Review of Books, a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, the author of five novels, Andrew?
Yes, I think so. I'm trying to keep up. It's hard, you know. Yeah. I mean, people think you've got an insider track just because you write them, but that is, in fact, a fallacy. I'm scratching my head. Let's say five.
Of which the latest is Mayflies, and that was published recently by Faber. But that is all secondary to Andrew's most notable achievement. In 1986, listeners, I went to the H&R Cloak record shop in Croydon. That's the first mention of Croydon today, but not the last.
Not the last. Oh, no.
To buy a single by a band that I had heard on the John Peel show called The Big Gun. And little did I imagine, 34 years later, that I would be doing a thing called a podcast, which didn't exist, on the internet, which didn't really exist, with the percussionist from The Big Gun, Andrew O'Hagan.
Andy, my heart swells at this information, I have to say. Crossed continents to meet you.
You found your fan, Andrew. It's brilliant.
We sold a total, I think, of two copies. And my mother's happy to step forward as the proud owner of the other copy. But here you are, Andy. I've been searching for years. I mean, there are tears in my face now.
Oh, genuinely. I said before we started that certain things had come to light in the last few hours. That was
it's
one
brilliant.
Of them. I couldn't believe it.
I wish I could say that your wise purchase saw me clear to buy my first house. Unfortunately, we're still paying back the presser of that record somewhere in the lovely town of Kilmarnock, Ayrshire, from
That's
30
so
years
great.
Ago.
Oh, my That's, goodness.
Well, that is a very happy, happy thing. Brilliant.
Joining Andrew is the novelist Rachel Joyce. Rachel is the author of the international bestsellers The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, Perfect, The Love Song of Miss Queenie Hennessy, and The Music Shop. Her books have appeared in 36 languages. She has been longlisted for the Booker Prize, shortlisted for the Commonwealth Prize, and was awarded New Writer of the Year in the 2012 Specsavers National Book Awards. And her latest novel, Miss Benson's Beetle, was published recently by Doubleday. Rachel, have you been in any bands in my record collection?
I could lie.
Lie.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. All of them. Yeah, strangely. Yeah. No, I haven't. No, I was never just not musical. I really wish I was. It was so cool to be musical, but I just
wasn't. You
didn't
wasn't need to be
person.
To be honest, back
no.
not when I was a kid anyway.
No, that's just also
to,
true.
Just had to be a show off. That seemed to work quite well.
But you are quite into music. I was reading an interview with you where you were hymning 12 tona.
Oh yeah, I love 12 tona. In Iceland, in Reykjavik. Yes.
The Reykjavik's finest music emporium, yeah.
It came about because I love record shops. And so I just thought, well, this would be a very good form of research, just having to go and spend a lot of time in them, which is what I did. And 12 Tonar was, I mean, I love that. It's about one of the best.
It's a shame we're not here to talk about music, really, isn't it? Right. Well, the book actually we're here to talk about is Thérèse Raquin, the third published novel by the great French master of naturalism, Émile Zola. Originally serialized in the literary journal L'Artiste under the title A Love Story, it was first released in volume form as Thérèse Raquin by Albert Lacroix in December 1867. And despite some famously disparaging reviews, became an immediate bestseller and established Zola's literary reputation. But before we slip into the back streets of not-so-gay Paris, Andy, what have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a book called Cecil Beaton's Bright Young Things, written by Robin Muir. It's actually the exhibition catalogue that was published to tie in with an exhibition of the same title, focusing on Cecil Beaton's early photography in the 1920s and the social set that featured in it, which ran for 5 days at the National Portrait Gallery, opened on March the 12th, 2020, and closed on March the 17th because of COVID. So the vast majority of people never got to see this exhibition. And I imagine if you are the publisher of NPG Books, you've got a huge unsold print run, which you would have expected to sell through in the NPG gift shop. But now this is the main record of that exhibition. And listeners will remember that I've been following my own little path this year through books that are to do with British artistic movements and culture between the wars. John Piper's Brighton Aquatints, Romantic Moderns, Square Haunting, those are all books that I've talked about this year. And this book actually works remarkably well as a book in its own right. I didn't go to the exhibition and I won't get to go, but in a way, actually sitting and reading an exhibition catalogue from cover to cover is probably an experience that we don't have very often. And I found it incredibly rewarding. It's very well put together. It's really beautifully designed. It has biographies and excerpts from Beaton's journals to accompany each photograph. And the cast of characters includes the various members of the Sitwell clan, William Walton, Lady Diana Cooper, Lord Berners, Stephen Tennant, Daphne du Maurier, Sylvia Townsend Warner, and many, many toffs, routinely described as the most beautiful woman of their generation. What's so interesting about it is it's a group of individuals who are both deeply attractive and utterly repulsive. there's a tension constantly going on between these beautiful people and their appalling politics and behaviour. And I reread Vile Bodies after I read this. I read The Well of Loneliness for the first time because both Radcliffe Hall and Evelyn Waugh feature in the exhibition and in the book. In fact, here's a little bit, the section about Evelyn Waugh. Cecil Beaton and Evelyn Waugh held towards each other a lifetime of mutual loathing, which for 8-year-old Cecil started in 1912 as a day boy at Heathmount Preparatory School, Hampstead, where Waugh, a year older, was also a pupil. In his memoir, A Little Learning, 1964, Waugh remembered Cecil as, quote, a tender and very pretty little boy. The tears on his long eyelashes used to provoke the sadism of youth, and my cronies and I tormented him on the excuse that he was reputed to enjoy his music lessons. And then Beaton subsequently recalled, Evelyn was already an experienced bully, and his expert eyes had seen in me, from a distance of 30 yards, a mother's pretty, an excessively timid darling who was an easy victim for ridicule and torture. My arms were turned back to front and my face spattered with spit from the pea shooters. And there's clearly a 40-year psychodrama that then plays itself out between Cecil Beaton and Evelyn Waugh, which I'd not really appreciated that had been a thing, but they were constantly running into one another. You know, they moved in the same social circles. There's a fantastic photograph here of Evelyn Waugh at Ashcombe, Cecil Beaton's beautiful house in Wiltshire, where you can sort of see all the enmity that Waugh has for Cecil Beaton in that picture. He's looking at him with the pea shooter just out of shot there, you can see. So it's a really, really good book. And I find Cecil Beaton endlessly fascinating. This is just about one aspect of his career. And coincidentally, Ashcombe in Wiltshire has just gone on the market for £4 million, being sold by its current owner, Mr. Guy Ritchie, the film director. So with perhaps the Big Gun Millions, Andrew, you could think about saving that for the nation.
I would pay more attention to you, but I'm on the phone to my real estate dealer as we speak. There's really interesting that thing about enmity among that crowd. You know, it passed down the generations. Evelyn's son, Oberon Waugh, made himself hated by the novelist that posh people call Anthony Poe and everybody else calls Anthony Powell. By referring to him in the Literary Review constantly, referring to Poe as the horse-faced dwarf. Every time he had the opportunity to review one of his books, he would use those words and was it was set in every occasion. It was to drive Poe mad, his wife admitted. So that enmity became a bit of a kind of generational thing. They just passed it on to each other, I think.
It's not a book that you finish and think, gosh, I'd like to go down to the pub with those people. but secure in the knowledge, nor would they want to go down to the pub with you. So that's fine. Anyway, that's really good. That's published by a national MPG, and it's quite expensive, but if you look around, you can find it relatively cheap. So why don't you do that? Right, John, what have you been reading this week?
Actually, I've been reading this book for probably 20 years on and off. It's, I think, one of the great works of the 20th century. I don't know whether you'd call it history, even it's by the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, and even he's not really sure what it was. It's called Memory of Fire. It's a three-volume history of the Americas with a focus on Latin America, but it takes the whole of the continent. The structure is the thing that I love most about it. It's written in very small chunks, and like an anthology. Although what he says is, I don't think it's really an anthology. So it's bits of fiction, it's bits of history, it's bits of journalism, it's first-hand accounts, it's poetry. It starts with the creation myths gathered from all over the continent. And he kind of works through in the first book, which is called Genesis, through creation myths, first contact, up into the 18th century. Then the second book is the 18th century and the 19th century, which is the sort of the formation of dictatorships and the rise of America. And then the final century of the wind, the final, which I've just finished, is the 20th century. It's a magnificent sort of symphonic work of both history and imagination. What he says is, I don't know to what literary form this voice of voices belongs. Memory of Fire is not an anthology, clearly not, but I don't know if it is a novel or an essay or an epic poem or a testament or a chronicle, but deciding robs me of no sleep. I do not believe in the frontiers that, according to literature's custom officers, separate the forms. It tells a terrible story. It tells a story of genocide, exploitation, disease. But he does it in such a way that you're drawn into the characters. You meet the cast of characters, obviously, is epic, from unknown shaman in Amazonian tribes all the way through to characters like Billy the Kid.
So when did you start reading this then?
So it was published between 1982 and 1986. And I should also say Galeano he's known as one of the great kind of left-wing heroic writers of South America. He was Uruguayan, went into exile, lived in Spain for a long time and came back to Uruguay in 1985. But the first volume, Genesis, was written when he was still living in Spain. He's one of the best literary writers about football. So he has a whole other fan base. Not I know something that you're going to love.
That's why that aspect is not familiar to me.
That Venn diagram.
Yeah.
So I started reading it back when I was a bookseller. Right. So it's probably 30 years ago.
Wow.
I finally decided I wanted to finish it. So I've reread that in the last 6 months, I've reread the whole thing again and found it even more inspiring.
Okay. So that is the Memory of Fire trilogy by Eduardo Galeano.
Okay, it's time now for an advert.
One of the things about this novel is it has inspired multiple adaptations and interpretations in the last 150, 160 years in all sorts of musical genres. So we're going to be hearing a few different things in the course of the show today. So that's opera. You can tick, if you had opera on your card, you can tick that off. Rachel, can you remember when or where you first read this novel?
I can. I mean, there's a lot I can't remember, it has to be said. But I really remember it. I was 18 And I decided to hitch down through France to Avignon to get to the theatre festival. And I took Thérèse Racan with me. And I think rather arrogantly, an 18-year-old Lee read it quite ostentatiously in French. I don't know that I really understood a lot of it. So I did have to reread it, work out what was going on. But I was bowled over by it and have been ever since. It just really took a hold on me. I find it so bold and so dark, and I absolutely loved it. I think it is, I mean, as a young person as well, I think it does really, really speak to you. And I think I probably was quite dark. I still am quite dark. So, it was going to appeal to me. I remember sitting there in Avignon in these kind of, for the theatre festival, and then you were sort of sitting in little attics watching Beckett being played by, you know, an audience of two of us in deck chairs probably. And, you know, the Beckett would go on for about 6 hours. And there I was with Thérèse Racan. No, not even supposed to, but with Thérèse Racan. It just completely worked. It really suited my image. Brilliant.
Held up prominently for all to see.
It worked on so many levels, even if I didn't completely understand it.
I had a similar experience. I read it, oh gosh, in 1987, I think.
Right.
And hadn't reread it until I knew we were going to be doing it for this. And I was really surprised at how much of the, you know, some books change a lot, don't they? You don't change, the books change. Some books change a lot in that gap. Actually, I was astonished at how much of Thérèse Racan I could remember, and also how much of the mood of it, the feeling of it, had stayed with me over 30 years.
I couldn't agree more. The golden light is interesting because I think of it as a green light.
You mean the yellow light that filters through the book? You think of it as a green light?
It feels like green everywhere, that kind of mossy, oozy. I mean, there's so much ooze in this book, isn't there? So much slime.
It's the grimmest Paris novel, I think.
You know what, John? It is the grimmest Paris novel. And that's saying something, because we did Huisman's on Backlisted a while ago. he's no slouch on the grim front.
No, he's not a barrel of laughs.
Andrew, when did the force... the Zola force. Writer doesn't really do justice to it, does it? When did Emile Zola first enter your life, your understanding?
The comical story for me is that the words Thérèse Racan were legend in our house. I grew up the youngest of four boys in a house 25 miles outside Glasgow. And in 1980, when I was 12, there was a BBC adaptation of Zola's famous novel in which there was loads of sex. And we were banned from the living room by my Catholic parents during the broadcast. And much staring through banister slats and looking through the tops of doors to try and get a glimpse of this pair rolling about on a French bed as we allowed ourselves to think of it. And indeed it was. But so for years, I wondered, what is this Thérèse Racan? And actually, it wasn't the Zola that I read first. It was 4 years after that, of course, in Ayrshire, which is where we were, as well as all over the country, the great big subject was the miner strike. And it was during the miner strike in 84, in autumn of that year, that I picked up Germinal, his great novel about the strike in northern France, almost in the Belgian border. That classic, I think. I mean, there is no book like Germinal, and it sent me into a place of proper empathy, I think, with the British miners in 84. I mean, so many of us were reading that. We didn't have book clubs then, but we had a tattered copy that was passed from boy to girl to boy to girl in our community. And it gave us an understanding of exactly what was at stake humanly in that great conflict in Britain. So that then sent me, of course, out into all of Zola, or at least as much of it as you could get a hold of in Ayrshire in the 1980s. but of course, venally, Thérèse Racan, for other reasons, was still in my mind. And I eventually did get a hold of it. It didn't disappoint on the sizzle front, I have to say. There's so much that we'll go on to discuss. But it's a sexy book.
Okay, well, Andrew, listeners, hang on to your hats, because as luck would have it, here is a clip from that that suppressed adaptation.
What on earth did you marry Camille for?
I was brought up with him.
Why? What happened to your parents?
My mother was a foreigner, Algerian, Moroccan. She died when I was little. Ran off with someone more like.
More like?
My father was drowned at sea.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Madame Raquin was his sister. She brought me up since I was six. In the same room as Camille. He was always ill. And I always had to take a spoonful of his medicine or he wouldn't. I slept in the same bed with him. And the smell of his body made me feel sick. I don't know why I didn't die. And then when I grew up, it just seemed natural to go on living in the same bedroom. Madame Raquin was always kind. But Camille turned out to be the same feeble, sickly creature I'd been sleeping with since I was six.
You should have married me. I'm not feeble.
That's Kate. I'd just like to warn listeners retrospectively that that was Kate Nelligan as Thérèse Raquin and Brian Cox as Laurent, and they were in bed in that scene, and they apparently had no clothes on. So your parents were right to protect you.
I think they were right to protect me from that dialogue more than anything else. As literary adaptations go, shall we just agree that that's slightly over-explicit?
Yeah, yeah. But Rachel, you were saying earlier, like Kate Nelligan is really, they play that whole piece in that adaptation as melodrama, but because they've cast it so brilliantly, Alan Rickman is in it as well, and she is particularly good in it.
I think she is especially good. I think she, I mean, I do remember it when it was on. Obviously, I was allowed to see it. I don't know what that says about my home life. But anyway, we'll just skip along very, very merrily. But I do remember it was her for me. She's so, it's kind of visceral. I mean, you felt she was Thérèse. And when she has a sort of anger and a, you know, steeliness to her, and yet such vulnerability. I mean, never fragile, which is what I really love about her.
Yeah. It's that strange way that she can go from looking, she can have a very mean face to an incredibly beautiful, smouldering, kind of sexy. It's great.
That's beautifully consistent, John, with how Zola has it in the novel. I mean, when he first considers having an affair with her, he says, you know, she's not good looking. But as time goes on, he begins to see that she's sort of ravishing and incredibly, he becomes obsessively interested in how sexy she looks.
Yeah, what does he call it? Desire's secret work begins to work on him. I love that. It's the Zola, the old we'll talk about Zola, the kind of the idea of him as an experiment. The whole thing is an experiment into morals and human behavior, the laws behind human behavior.
Rachel, you said you'd read it again recently, over the last week or so. Were there things that had changed since the first time you read it?
I think I was more aware this time of how meticulously plotted it felt. Just this kind of, the descent is, I mean, I went through each chapter, and I could go through each chapter going, oh, this is where hatred comes, you know, this is remorse, this is, it's so finely, I don't mean plotted, I mean, I do mean plotted, but charted, I suppose, is a better word for it. Mm. And, you know, and I saw things, I mean, which you only, I mean, it's the delicious thing about rereading, isn't it? So that, you know, when they go to the river, the sun is biting his neck. And you, I mean, it's just a kind of slight delicious kind of freestyle, because you just think this writer is so in this that the whole thing seems to be, you know, alive and evident to him. So I'm full of admiration for it. I mean, I do really love it. I love how unflinching it is. And I love that it goes to places that it really should not go, and it delivers.
Yeah, there's a kind of remorseless fidelity, isn't there, to the idea that he's set up. You know, unflinching is right. You might want to look away, reader, but I won't.
Yeah, and you're going to see the whole thing and you're going to really, really go with it. And not only that, I'm going to lay it out for you why this is the case, why these. So it's never kind of gratuitous, because even if you despise it or are appalled or don't want to look away, whatever, you understand why they're doing what they're doing.
Andrew, it's sort of a psychological novel before psychology has been defined as a science, isn't it?
Absolutely, and science is the right word, I think, in this context. I mean, I think Rachel expresses it very well. There's something utterly forensic about the form of this book. It's a sort of perfect novel of its kind. You know, it's not for everyone, and the style of it is so self-advertisingly naturalistic, scientific, and so on. But that forensic patterning of the human experience in the book is so deftly done that it's sentence by sentence quite perfect. I read it again recently, preparing to talk to you all, and just was so bowled over by the fact that, as Rachel said, it's not plot. I mean, thriller writers can do plot. They can do surprising twists and turns. There aren't really many surprises in this, but it's a proper unfolding of psychological motive and then the action of guilty conscience in a terrible relationship. I mean, psychologically, it goes all the way in to the rather sort of dark terribleness of what they did and how they did it, and then what they're left with by way of guilt and trying to recover. And Henry James later said that there was something so crude and ugly about Zola's talent, and yet he had something, said James. Yeah. And you know what he means, that, yes, it is quite ugly sometimes, and it's been mentioned, that sickly greenness and that yellow light that comes through. It's full of premonition, though, in a way that a plotty writer wouldn't know how to offer, as it were, subconscious ammunition to the reader, the way that Zola does. You'll remember that when Laurent is painting that portrait early in the book of Camille, it's described at one point his face as looking green, like a drowned man.
You know,
in the wrong hands, that would be crude. But actually, it just feels like a gentle premonition. But it's properly forensic, and it gives you a little dull bell in your head that something very terrible is going to occur in this book. And yet when it comes with all the incredible, meticulous drama of the best writing.
But you get that from the opening, you know. He is brilliant at scene setting, Zola, but the sense of claustrophobia, of suffocation, of the shop, of the dust, of the greasiness of the cobblestones and the light, and you never, as I say, apart from the one trip to where they go and order their cooked chicken out in next to the Seine, and despite Madame Racan's attempt to create, she likes the shop, the haberdashers, because it's quiet, because it reminds her of the country. But it's such a claustrophobic, and that thing of being buried, of drowning, of suffocation.
Absolutely,
those themes just are woven all the way through the novel.
It takes a writer of very rare talent, I think, to describe boredom not boringly. And those Thursday nights when the friends come round with the dominoes, I mean, it's stultification beautifully anatomized, but it's, if anything, exciting to read. I mean, that's an enormously brilliant trick, that.
Yes, Rachel, what is the pulse in this book? What is the thing? I agree with what Andrew was saying, what you were saying. It's very gripping, and yet, as we've just said, it's not plot that's gripping you, is it? You're not reading it thinking, oh, I wonder if they'll be found out. That's not the motive.
No, although that extraordinary moment when Madame Racan starts to move with her finger on the table, Laurent and Thérèse have, and then that buffoon of a man, I can't remember his name now, is it Grivet or Michaud, says, you know, look what she's telling us, they're so kind. I can read her eyes. And that's another, just going back to that adaptation, because I do think a lot about adaptations of Thérèse Racan, but the Kate Nelligan one, I cannot now remember the name of the actress, but playing Madame Racan.
It's Mona Washbourne,
yeah.
Most famous for playing Billy Liar's mum in the film, right. Billy Liar.
Quite early on, the murder is committed, isn't it? And I don't think you ever really think that they're going to get away from it. And I read somebody saying, why don't they just leave? And the point is, you accept that they cannot leave. I mean, he does give you a reason, and it's money, but that seems just rather sideways. It's that they're locked in this hell, in this room, and then first it's in the bedroom, and then it just slightly expands.
Rachel, adaptations, what is the thing that makes Thérèse Racan so endlessly adaptable, do you think? Because there have been numerous stage, film, other productions.
Well, Zola famously did it himself. That was really was what sort of turbocharged its fame and success, was his adaptation.
I think it's probably as a dramatist, because I've adapted quite a lot, but nobody's ever let me have Thérèse Racan, and I really have tried. But I think it's because it is so rich, the stakes are so high. But also the way that it's told, it's not like you're given information, but you're often not given the actual scene. So, for instance, a really kind of crucial scene, I'd say, if you were writing a dramatization, would be where Laurent discovers that Madame Racan is not going to recover from her stroke. That is a kind of, that's a turning point in the drama. In the book, that is one sentence. And it's just referred to as something that happened. So that dramatically, it feels as if there's a lot to kind of to play with. It's a very rich place. But also, because so much is about subtext in this book, so often people having a conversation are not saying the thing. They're just, for whatever reason. Or they're kind of dealing with unconscious thought, unconscious feelings or conscious thoughts, so that there are many, many layers. And I think dramatically, when you don't simply have a scene where people are saying this happened, that happened, where there's actually very rich subtext, you get a really crisp, dynamic tension. And it's really exciting to write, and it's really exciting to watch.
It's really interesting. So much of this book takes place in the consciousness of the characters.
Yes.
So, I mean, there are challenges in doing that well on stage, aren't there? I mean,
I think on stage it's tough, because stage, if I were doing it, I would want to see Camille. I would want to see that bed where the two of them try to lie down, and then that Laurent, they can't move because Laurent is afraid of touching the pulpy flesh.
Pulpy flesh.
So disintegrating, wet flesh. I need to see that. On stage, it's almost as if stage, it's to do with different levels of reality, isn't it? And stage, even though it is kind of such a suspended way of telling a sort of a truth, I think it almost can't take it. Whereas film, I think, could, because it's, in a way, it's so big and so subtle.
Andrew, Zola famously wanted to present this novel, or after the event, wished to present it as the product of a scientific inquiry. And it's the founding text of naturalism. In fact, the next episode of That Listed is about The Odd Women by George Gissing, inspired by Zola and by the naturalist movement. But I found rereading it that, in addition to being ahead of its time psychologically, you could also see elements of, there's a gothic sensibility to it. And there's, fascinatingly, Rachel, in terms of adaptation, there's a real film noir thing going on in Thérèse Racan.
Yeah.
She is a femme fatale, absolutely, yeah.
Double Indemnity, James Caine, pulp. You can see there's a kind of pulp feeling to it as well, Andrew.
The descriptive power is just absolutely amazing. I mean, it's hard to think of a writer whose descriptive powers are sharper, more enormous, more encompassing than Zola's. Let's just have a look for a second at that essay, The Experimental Novel, published in 1880. I just want to read a couple of paragraphs from it, because it gives you actually chapter and verse from him about his methodology. "We should operate on the characters," he wrote, "the passions, on the human and social data, in the same way that the chemist and the physicist operate on inanimate beings, and as the physiologist operates on living beings. Determinism dominates everything." And later, he writes, "Today we feel the necessity of analysing anger and love, of discovering exactly how such passions work in the human being. This view of the matter is a new one. We have become experimentalists instead of philosophers. In short, everything is summed up in this great fact. The experimental method in letters, as in the sciences, is in the way we explain the natural phenomena, both individual and social, of which metaphysics until now has given only irrational and supernatural explanations. That's what he gave us in that essay. But Andy, you're right. He wasn't actually 100% true to his own method. Despite his journalistic powers and his brilliant reporting and his amazing descriptive capacity, he was quite supernatural. And there are episodes in this novel, don't you agree, Rachel, where they start to, it's phantasmagoric, they start to have nightmares and see shapes in the dark.
Ghosts, haunting, vampirism, you know, they're continually harking on about the wound on his neck and she says it's bleeding.
That's another adaptation, you know, of which we don't have a clip. There was an adaptation in 2009 called Thirst.
Yeah.
As a vampire film in Korea.
It's a shame.
Rachel, I'd love you to read a bit. And I'm just going to set it up, if I may, by picking up what Andrew was saying about Zola's willingness to not be a scientist, but be a novelist, in fact. This is the blurb. This will help people if they haven't read Thérèse Racan. This is the blurb from a 1950s paperback, American paperback, of Thérèse Racan. The book was published as Teresa.
Teresa!
I don't know.
Teresa!
Teresa!
This is how you sold this book in the 1950s. And it is worth saying before I read this that for many, many years, Zola was certainly in Britain and America, firstly, not much translated. And when he was translated, he was sold as lurid and bannable.
Well, he was banned and his publisher went to jail in the UK, Liz Etterly.
So here we go. Here's the blurb from Teresa. She listened only to the demands of the flesh. In those words lies the core of this woman's story. With Teresa's submission to her lover begins the smouldering drama that drives two people down and down the path of human degradation. Emile Zola, master of bold, unsparing realism, has here written a novel that ranks with the world's most compelling stories of men and women in the clutch of passions too strong for them to control. Any feelings about that, Rachel?
Yeah. It gets me right from the first sentence, to be honest. I mean, I suppose they had to sell it, didn't they? What really gets me that, well, first that it's her, it's all her fault. I feel very strongly about the way she's described at the beginning and that she is a woman on hold. She kind of comes alive with the murder, but she's been sacrificed, it seems to me, by Madame Racan for Camille. And really, the sacrifice is Madame Racan's because her love for her sickly son is so intense, as anyone's would be, that she can't bear the pain of him suffering. That's Madame Racan. You know, that's her love. So she needs to smooth it to make it easier by marrying off this girl, you know, by matching him up. But Thérèse is used right from the start. And I love the descriptions of her just angrily watching everybody at those domino games. But as the book progresses, we understand more and more about that state in which she's put herself. So even kind of describing her disposition as nervous seems a strange one to me, because she's just a woman who's been made not to feel anything, who's had no, you know, all her decisions have been taken away from her.
Could we hear a little?
Yes. I mean, one bit is just the bit where she's sitting there at these Thursday dominoes. This is early on.
Could I ask which translation you've got there?
Well, I do have the Adam Thorpe translation, which I really loved. I think it's such an intelligent translation.
Yeah, it's good.
We featured Ulverton by Adam Thorpe on an earlier episode of Backlisted, we're pro Adam Thorpe here.
Oh, I love that book. Love it. Her elbow on the table, cheek pillowed on the palm of her hand, she would watch her aunt and her husband's guests, seeing them through a kind of yellow, smoky fog given off by the lamp, all these people enraged her. She would turn from one to the other with profound loathing, a dull exasperation. Old Michaud would display a deathly pale face, spotted with red blotches, the type of lifeless face that old men have in their dotage. Grivet had the tight mask, the round eyes and thin lips of a cretin. Olivier, whose bones pierced his cheeks, earnestly bore a stiff, insignificant head on his ridiculous body. As for Suzanne, Olivier's wife, she was pale all over, with vague eyes, white lips, a slack expression. And Thérèse could not find a man, not a single living soul among these grotesque and sinister creatures she was shut up with. At times she was overcome by hallucinations, thinking herself buried at the bottom of a vault, surrounded by mechanical corpses, waggling their heads, jiggling their legs and arms when their strings were twitched. The heavy air of the dining room choked her. The chill silence, the lamp's yellowish glimmers thrilled her with a vague terror, an inexpressible dread. I love it because it's so angry and yet it's just deadened. Even when you read that, you think something's got to happen. You cannot carry on like that.
Andrew, in this novel, and I think this is true of other novels by Zola, is it fair to say he likes a set piece, doesn't he? He likes, for instance, in this novel, the trip to the morgue or the visit of the one painter to look at Laurent's paintings. And in Germinal, the incredible scenes of specific things where he set himself the task of describing something he can't possibly have seen or has seen, and reproducing it with as much fidelity as he can.
I think when it comes to the morgue scene, for example, he very much did see it. I mean, the reporter in him was very strong. And that muscle, if you like, the journalistic one, I mean, he would absolutely exercise it. He went into the Paris morgue again and again. He knew exactly what he was describing. You know, one of the things that you hear in the extract that Rachel just read, and we'll hear in this extract I'm about to read from the morgue scene, is it's an absolute reverse of everything that is taught in creative writing courses around the world. Isn't it true? The first thing they say to you when you come in the door is, drop all your adjectives, cut them all out. Well, not if you're Emile Zola, you don't. It's the right adjective, though, in every case. It's like a kind of impressionist painting, but thickly impastoed.
So painterly.
More detail. More. You could see how he was close to Cézanne. You know, that use of the palette knife to put more and more slick, oozing, to use Rachel's word, oozing detail everywhere in the novel. Let me just give you a paragraph or two from the morgue scene. When he entered, he was nauseated by a sickly smell, the smell of washed flesh, and chill shivers ran over his skin. The dampness of the walls seemed to make his clothes weigh heavier on his shoulders. He made straight for the window separating the onlookers from the corpses, glued his pale face to the glass, and looked. Rows of grey stone slabs stretched out in front of him. Here and there on the slabs lay naked bodies, making patches of green and yellow, white and red. For some of the bodies had kept their flesh virgin white in the rigidity of death, but others were like heaps of rotting, bleeding meat. On the wall at the back were hanging pitiful tatters, skirts and trousers contorted against the bare plaster. At first, Laurent could only see a general impression of dingy grey slabs and walls on which the garments and corpses made red and black blotches. There was a murmur of running water. Gradually, he could make out the bodies, and then he passed from one to the next. He was only concerned with the drowned, and when there were several swollen and bluish from immersion, he studied them eagerly, trying to recognize Camille. Often, the flesh of the faces was coming away, bit by bit. The bones had pierced the soft skin, and the whole face was a mere flabby pulp. I mean, that's incomparable. There isn't another writer, I don't think of the period, who would have gone that far.
It goes way beyond Dickens, even in his reportage mode, doesn't it? It's amazing.
I borrowed this little book here from the London Library when I knew we were going to be doing this episode. This is study of Emile Zola's novels by Angus Wilson. It was the third book that Angus Wilson published in the early 1950s. And at the time he wrote it, the first thing to say is that most of Zola's work had not been translated. Yeah. And the second thing is that Wilson is very much focused on the Rougon Macquart 20 novel sequence. In the 1950s, he sees that as Zola's bid for immortality rather than Thérèse Raquin. Wilson is quite dismissive of Thérèse Raquin, but I found this very interesting and I'd like to ask you to comment on it. This is Angus Wilson talking about how sex plays out in Zola's work and the extent to which sex is not recessed in his novels and certainly not in Thérèse Raquin. This is what he writes. It's very short. For Zola, sex is the Achilles heel of humanity. Responsible parenthood, its crowning glory. Sex was a temptation into which a man might be led without the full use of his will. Habitual promiscuity was the negation of the will. The sexually promiscuous, in his books, are the indolent, the slipshod, the weak. The sexual act was a loss of energy, a further emphasis of the random futility of humanity in a determined, cruel world. Work, regular hours of writing, regular numbers of words written, was Zola's recipe for success and self-respect. Promiscuity was a sin against work.
I mean, you wouldn't want to be Zola, would you? I mean, he's not like those easy to confuse with those bright young things you were talking about before, Andy.
So true.
And yet that's the thing for a novel with, if we just take the example of Thérèse Raquin, for a novel with so much sex in it, which was sold, as that blurb I read earlier suggests, as a sexy book. It's one of the least sexy things you could ever read, isn't it? I mean, it's so full of loathing for the flesh.
Except in that early part, I think the desire is so raw in that early part that, you know, the combination of the boredom and, you know, being sick of the husband, and then this the way that a male straight writer is able to describe the desirability of Laurent is very strong. Remember the thickness of his neck, you know, the compacted flesh. I mean, it's homoerotic.
Yeah. I mean, I noticed as well that when I was looking through it, the sort of end, I would call it the end of Act One, if I was, because I started dramatizing it in my mind. But he says, this life of tossing about and cooling down lasted for 8 months. The lovers were living in a state of utter bliss. So there we are. That's the answer. Thérèse was no longer bored, desired nothing else. Laurent sated, pampered and fattened up even more, dreaded merely that he might see this lovely existence come to an end. It's a hunger and it's a need. And I think it's for her, it is a release.
It's interesting, by the end of the book, when there's a great passage where he says she felt that vice was failing her just as much as had the farce of remorse.
Yes, yes.
She had dragged herself in vain through all the cheap lodgings of the Latin Quarter.
Yeah.
In vain she had led a dirty, rowdy life. Her nerves were shattered. Debauchery, physical dissipation, these no longer gave her sufficiently violent spasms to procure her oblivion. God, I mean, that's attempting to dull yourself with sex, with empty sex.
It is true to say, isn't it, that in Zola's moral universe, there was a high price to be paid for hot sex.
Yeah.
You know, for all of them. You know, poor old Madame Raquin too. I mean, it's as if in the mind of Zola, you can't get away with it.
It's obviously the ending is not a happy ending, without giving too many spoilers away. But I reading it again this morning, I couldn't help thinking that the hell is the living in the room. Yes. The hell is other people.
It is.
Actually, the ending is that there's a kind of release. And, you know, for Zola, who is not a Christian, you know, he's sort of, you know, throughout his life against organized religion. I mean, I'd always thought that it was a sad ending, but it's the one way out that they have. And with Madame sitting there looking at them, kind of piled on the floor, maybe even for her as well.
I mean, I think it's extraordinary, that last paragraph, where it goes. I mean, it describes them as becoming children. And you think nowhere in the book has Thérèse ever felt like a child, or Laurent. Yes. They've never had that freedom. And something sweet and tender. Where has sweet and tender been in this book until this moment? I mean, and then, you know, that they realise what they've got to do. And the relief, the end for everyone. And it's done without him even saying that.
It was enormously influential, this novel. We should mention that, you know, that, you know, much as the critics were harsh at the time, and Zola seems to have spent his whole life, especially his life as a journalist, you know, riling people and being sort of pursued, indeed, you know, prosecuted for libel and so on, very famously, over the Dreyfus case, and fleeing to England, that actually that book reverberated right through the literatures of many cultures. You know, if you look at a writer like Theodore Dreiser and in American Tragedy, you know, it's unthinkable without Thérèse Racan. Even Nabokov, although he was always putting Zola down as a stylist, I mean, King, Queen, Knave has a boating scene straight out of Thérèse Racan. So the influence, I think, was massive. I mean, I'll never really be able to understand, I don't think, why a godless man was so compelled by the operations of conscience the way that he was. You know, that in some sense, you wonder what it would have been like, a version of this novel, if it was Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway, you know, running off into the sunset, having just murdered, you know, but they're the very opposite. They just can't go forward.
And he plays with a lot of Catholic stuff in the third act, doesn't he? With the, with the remorse, and there's a lot of, you know, the kneeling at Madame Racan's feet, asking for forgiveness.
Yes.
Now, normally on Backlisted, we do a straightforward biography, but Emile Zola led such an incident-packed life that we've prepared. Well, I've got written what Steve Wright would call five fun facts about Emile Zola, were he and the posse to discuss it. So Zola was born on April the 2nd, 1840, and he died on September the 29th, 1902. Born in Paris, died in Paris. He wrote approximately 30 novels. He was a journalist and a playwright and a librettist and a real figure in French public life. His most famous novels, in addition to Thérèse Racan, are Germinal, which we've talked about, L'Assommoir in 1877, Brilliant. Nana in 1880, La Bête Humaine in 1890. He writes the 20 novels in the Rougeant Macquart series in 22 years. And some of those are big novels. Germinal is 500-600 pages. So we've mentioned this already, but the first fact about Zola is Zola's best friend as a child was the painter Paul Cézanne. Zola was a great supporter of the Impressionists, and you can see painter technique at work in Thérèse Racan. The friendship with Cézanne came to an end with the publication of Zola's 1886 novel L'Oeuvre, which features a painter called Claude Lantier. And the last known correspondence between Zola and his childhood friend Paul Cézanne is the letter from Cézanne thanking him for the novel, which has just arrived. And thereafter, they never speak again. Zola was the head of publicity at publisher Hachette. Now, Andrew, you were talking about this. This is a thing that made Zola somewhat unpopular with his contemporaries in his lifetime. Flaubert initially was a great supporter of Zola, but grew weary of him, because he felt that Zola was always going for the publicity angle, the thing that would be sensational in the press.
And you know, he was never offering reassurance to anybody ever over anything. You know, he didn't see that as being a writer's responsibility to reassure the public or titillate them or entertain them. He wanted to, as it were, refine their morals and give them a sense of the world that they otherwise might not be able to access. He was an artist devoted to that cause, I think. But when it came to journalism, I mean, if you compare him to people today in the age of Twitter, I mean, where everybody gets wounded and sort of feels that they've not had their due, if they aren't immediately adored by hundreds of thousands of people on social media, or indeed get all hurt if they get a bit of a pile-on for a day or two, which we've all had, by the way, and it stings at the time, but you need to quickly go over it. Zola actively invited it. He loved a pile-on. And actually, the critics were always in wait for him, but the public too. I mean, over the Dreyfus case, I mean, here's a man who tried to stand up against an endemic, as we now say, anti-Semitism in the institutions of France. Lost the case, was done for libel, had to flee from England. I hope, by the way, Andy, and your fun facts about Zola.
Stop. You're going to spoil it because I know where you're going. I know where you're going with fun fact number four.
I'm going to hold it in reserve.
But yeah, he seems to have seen notoriety as not a negative quality, but something that will illuminate and bring clarity to an issue that he wants to write about.
And the bravery was so striking. I mean, he was in a way like a character in a French existentialist novel. He's like, you know, Meursault in Camus' The Outsider, you know, that last famous last paragraph where he says, you know, my final wish is that I should climb to the gallows and be met with cries of execration. He loved the idea of the public mob objecting to what he had to say. He wasn't one of those novelists always wheedling for approval.
Okay, so fun fact number three is that Emile Zola was a pioneer of the selfie.
That's true.
John, would you care to add to that?
He developed a little trigger, which at this stage, he had 10 cameras, he was a really keen amateur photographer. But obviously, mostly because long exposure time, a lot of the photographs of that time, they were taken in profile, they weren't taken full on. But he managed to get a trigger. So there are some really mournful pictures. Nadar, the great French photographer, was one of his friends. There are some really mournful pictures of him and his children. I put a few up on Twitter earlier, looking like they're having the worst possible time.
Yeah.
Talk about hell as other people.
Yeah.
He had a very complicated, at that time, personal life with his wife and his sort of other wife, mistress, who was the mother of his children. And they came over to London to stay with him. So he had a brief period where he was paterfamilias with them. But then Alexandrine came over, his actual wife. It's complicated, as they say.
Fun fact number four, as Andrew was suggesting, at one point during the Dreyfus affair, he'd been prosecuted and he had to go into exile, didn't he? Emile Zola spent Christmas 1898 in hiding at the Queen's Hotel in Upper Norwood, Croydon.
Yeah. Yay! That was the fun fact I wanted.
I thought it might be. Well, we're pro Adam Thorpe and we're pro Croydon on that listed. So I'm always looking to get a Croydon angle in.
Can I just add that he spent most of his time in Upper Norwood complaining about lack of window shutters?
Yeah. The terrible food.
Terrible things that English people did to vegetables.
He liked kippers. He developed a taste for kippers.
Which, really?
And Michael Rosen's written a book, hasn't he?
He has. Very good book.
Called The Disappearance of Emile Zola, about this period.
It was very well done, Rosen's book, because it gives you a sense of how somebody suffering very steeply from ennui could go even further if they just turned up in England at that particular period.
So ended up in Croydon, the capital, let's be honest, the capital city of ennui.
How dare you, Mitchinson? How dare you?
I'd like to add at this point that I was actually brought up in West Norwood, so I do have a Croydon.
Oh,
yes.
No!
Yep.
Right, okay. So I withdraw.
That's three Croydon mentions, listeners. I hope anyone who had that on their scorecard will have done very well.
It's at this point that Andy brings out an essay on Zola by Anita Bruckner, and the circle is complete, and we can all retire.
All right, and let's have the last fun fact. It's not really fun. Right. It's to do with his death. So Emile Zola died on September the 29th, as we said, in 1902 in Paris. He died of carbon monoxide poisoning from an improperly ventilated chimney. This continues to be debated about whether he died accidentally or whether he was murdered by his enemies. After he died, it was widely believed that he had been murdered. And then it swung back the other way when it was pointed out that it's actually quite a labor-intensive way to ensure that you can kill someone with carbon monoxide poisoning. That's a quite tricky
thing. Deathbed confession by the guy who'd fitted the chimney.
There was. Well, this is the fun fact. It was the chimney sweep. A report in 1953 that the chimney sweep Henri Bouron-Fosse had confessed on his deathbed to blocking the chimney, but obviously that's impossible to verify. But Zola, I think the thing that really surprised me, to bring this back round to the work, is he was 62 when he died, which I, whilst accepting that, you know, in that era is a reasonable age, he had still managed to fit in. It's nearly 30 novels. I mean, it's incredible output. Yeah. He has that Trollopian industry without being clearly anything like Trollope, that he clearly could sit down and produce, write the definitive scene that he wanted to write, and then be on to the next thing.
It's astonishing, actually, when you compare it to the way people talk about the writing vocation today, where your average novelist who produces a novel every 4 years and might occasionally write a restaurant review for The Guardian is described as having back-breaking industry, and people are always stroking their arm and saying, are you okay? You must be exhausted.
Before we wind up, I'd like to ask both of you a really straightforward but difficult question. So, Rachel, I'm going to pick on you first.
Oh, excellent. Okay.
What is Thérèse Racan about?
That's a very interesting question.
I'm glad you asked
me. Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, one of the things, because I've been working quite a lot, on, as I said, on adaptations and also film, and talking to somebody recently who's a film producer, she said, in any film, you have to ask yourself, what is the question that this film is asking? And I think that's always interesting to ask of a book. And so as I was going through the book, I was thinking, what is the question that this book, you know, what is it positing as an idea? And I came across that paragraph where Madame Racan realizes what Thérèse and Laurent have done. And her, it sort of describes her kind of sweet sense of the goodness of people being destroyed. And she realizes, and this is her, obviously her thinking, all is lies and all is crime. And I thought that's a very interesting question that this book might be asking, in that, is it all lies and is it all crime? Because it seemed to me that everybody in the book is lying and everybody has committed a crime of a kind. You know, whether or not it is this kind of enormous crime that is difficult to get away with, but they've all done something to somebody else, you know, to serve their own purposes, and they've got away with it. So that's where I came to with what it's about. I thought it's
brilliant.
It's asking me that question. Is it true? Is that the truth? And I feel at the end, the truth is not that. The truth is not that it is all lies and all crime. Yeah. And it's because of that last paragraph that I believe that.
Yeah. Really.
Andrew, same hard, easy question to you.
I'm reminded of the time somebody asked Tom Stoppard what Rosencrantz and Guildenstern was about. And he said, after a short pause, it's about to make me very rich. Zola has lasted. It's lasted, I think, because it is, as Rachel indicates, it's about human truth. You know, of course, all novels think they are, but this was an experimental, naturalistic effort to get at the truth of a particular moral and human problem. The problem of desire and its costs, of conscience and its drama, if you like. Ernest Hemingway loved Zola. And when somebody asked him why, he said, because it's just one true sentence after another.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about it, is that you just go through this book and all those rules, as we mentioned, about creative writing, about don't use adjectives, avoid adverbs, you know, don't explain things. He does all of it. He makes all the mistakes, quote unquote. Yeah. But, you know, there is no mistake because what you end up with is one true sentence after another and a kind of incredible philosophical confection that by the end, his experiment in the novel works, because you leave it with what? With an unforgettable series of images in your mind that will travel with you all your life.
It's right next to Crime and Punishment with we in 19th century novels. It's just, it's a great, great book. Right. Well, I mean, that's where we've got to leave off this particular literary investigation. A huge thank you to Andrew and Rachel for guiding us through the gloomy alleyways of this haunting novel, to Nikki Birch for weaving our disembodied voices into a harmonious whole, and to Unbound for the steadying glasses of absinthe.
Steadying glasses of absinthe. You can download all 119 previous episodes, plus follow links, clips and suggestions for further reading by visiting our website at batlisted.fm. And we're always pleased if you contact us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram or via our Patreon.
Yeah, you can show your love directly. Patreon.com/backlisted. We aim to survive without paid for advertising, but quality demands we spend time and therefore money, and your generosity helps us do that. All patrons get to hear backlisted episodes early and for less than the price of a Parisian baguette or a roast chicken. Lot listeners get two extra lot listeds a month, the upstairs room where we three go to play dominoes and talk about books, music, films, television, whatever takes our fancy.
What a lovely image.
Yeah, there you go.
Lock listeners also get to hear their names read out on the show as a mark of our thanks and appreciation. And this week's batch of listeners are, why don't you go first, John?
Here we go. Gail Johnson, Michelle Salloway-Cook, Leslie Cogher, Michael Riley, Stephen Bowden, Lisa Grab, Ryan Conley, David Yarrow, David Keenan. Hey. Thanks, David. Yeah, a former guest, great writer. Sheena Gordon, Tony Lyons.
Cheers, Tony.
Catherine Kelly, Veronica Steinberg, Mariska Costeris, and Joe Forshaw. Thank you, Joe.
Annie Lennon, Lynn Robinson, Matthew Oglesby, Neil Christie, Ben Tai, Lawrence Piercy, Chetna Maru, Neil Sargent. Hi, Neil. Lisa Borgness, Kate Lombardo, Nicola Newman, Amanda Oatway, Bronwyn Martin, Cyril Simpson, and somebody called Carmen Khalil. I don't know. I've never heard of her. Anyway, thank you all of you for supporting us.
We'll be back with you again in a fortnight. Thank you again to Andrew and to Rachel. If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole two extra episodes of what we call Lock Listed, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.